Hello. Welcome to Leaving Erinsborough, the Neighbours Rewatch podcast from the very beginning. I'm Sarah Gibbs. I'm a comedy writer, author of Drama Queen and another book called Eight Bright Lights. And we are back. I am here with...
Hello, I'm Rachel Krieger. I'm a stand-up comedian and writer, and I'm very excited to be chatting about Neighbours again. The world's been full of dramas that are in real life, so it's really nice to turn to dramas that are pretend.
Yeah, pretend and really very stupid. Very low stakes.
I have to say, before we kick off, that everyone's nice messages on social media about hope everything's all right when you're coming back, whatever, has been one of the lovely, heartening things of this interim gap. So I just want to say a big thank you to everyone who sent us supportive messages and was asking when we're going to be chatting again for you. And here we are, ready to dissect the lives of people in Erinsborough in the 1980s.
Yep, we're doing the Lord's work here. It's a new year here, it's 2024, so we are, I don't even know how many years, like 42 years, no, 38 years, I can't do maths.
Me neither.
This is 1986, how old am I? Yeah, we're about 38 years on. So,
I'm still trying to do the maths. I don't know if you can hear the thing coming out as the cogs turn.
I'm dyscalculic, so someone cleverer than me, please do the maths on this time travel. Let's kick off. What did you think about this block of episodes in general? How are you feeling, Rachel?
I thought, and I don't want to upset anybody, I thought they were quite boring.
They were quite boring
and really repetitive, and really like, if you've got a point to make, why don't you make it over and over and over again and really hammer it home so no one can miss it? And and it made me really lose sympathy with a lot of people who sort of deserve sympathy, because I just felt like I'd had enough, like, I got it, let's move on and let something happen. Well, I suppose it happened, it's the past, but it was a lot. And also, so many people are just nasty in it. Like, really, honestly, a lot of my notes are, oh, this person's awful, this person's awful, this person's awful. And I don't even need to say why, because they're just inherently being awful. Some shocking decisions being made, but I suppose not shocking when you think about who the characters are. So,
no. And the time that they're living in, it was a different time where you were allowed to be an arsehole and nobody would call you out on it as long as you were, you know, white and straight and probably a man. But anyway, it's pretty much like now. but yes, let's kick off. I've divided. There's lots of tiny little subplots this month, so I've divided everything into its tiny subplots. I put them in a completely arbitrary order. So let's pick one at random. Bradley, Andrea, and Jack Lasseter. What a bummer.
Sorry for the sick noise. everything about that storyline is so horrendous. I mean, and I speak not just as a previous social worker, but as a actual human being. The pride and excitement in marrying someone who was abusive to your child is weird. And her relentless enthusiasm for it suddenly being an amazing love story when she was quite clear previously that she just wanted stability with someone wealthy is irritating. And, her absolute desire for Bradley to be enthusiastic about it and everyone else kind of just changing their tack and going along with that, like Des's encouragement of this, I don't know, it's so odd.
Yeah, basically they got to write them out somehow and get them out as quickly as possible. We don't have time for questions.
No, but the process of them leaving, I mean, it was sort of, I don't know if it was sort of fun, sort of weird, because first of all you had the triple engagement celebration, which really made me laugh, of Des and Daphne, Jack and Andrea, and then, of course, Bradley saying, but it's really three of us, isn't it? Because me and Lucy are engaged. And it made me honestly want to send them, you know, a set of three trivets or something, like for Lucy and Bradley. So that was the triple engagement. And then the sort of farewell process where suddenly everyone's best friends with Andrea. Oh, I know we didn't always see eye to eye when you were completely evil, But you know, hey ho, and I don't mean like hey sex worker. You know, what should we? We're all friends now. I wish you well. You know, the forgetfulness I feel has come too quickly. She hasn't really had a time or chance to, what's the word for it? When you
redemption arc, like, yeah,
yes, that sort of didn't happen. She just was bad, and then she's less bad. And I enjoyed Zoe saying, you know, like, never mind about the dead animals and the scary phone calls. Like, I kind of love you now, Bradley, even though that's happened about 10 seconds ago. In the interim, I've been in hospital. It was very surreal. But his farewell with Lucy, I mean, that was really cute. That was really, really cute. She obviously wanted an emotional farewell and hugs and kisses, and he wasn't ready for that. But he gave her his comics. And we all know, when you're like a kid of that age, that's like, that's such a gesture. I used to collect comics, and there has never been, I mean, when I still collected them, there was never a boy I'd have given them to. So, like, that's major, major. But at the end, he does come back and, you know, give a little hug and a kiss, and says, wait for me, Lucy. And I thought that was hilarious and quite cute.
I hope she's still waiting for him. She's not, though, is she? She's married to that weird guy where, if I remember correctly, the sight of them kissing made me feel not good things.
I mean, many...
For some reason.
Much river under the bridge is what I was going to say, which is also, I mean... It's
sounds like a fortune cookie.
But, like, I have written about 8 times on here, Jack Lester is awful. Jack Lester is awful. He is awful. And his he did say something before he told her about the, you know, the devastating news that he wanted to take her to Paris. He said something really vile. I'm just trying to find. I wrote it down. I believe decisions should be left up to the husband.
Yeah.
And from that point onwards, I have nothing to add. I mean, he said,
yeah.
Is he selling to Paul? He's not selling to Paul. It's like, none of that is interesting. He's just an awful human, and he wants to wreak devastation on a family by taking them to Paris for 6 months.
Yeah. So basically, a little content warning here, because I'm going to be talking about domestic violence for a second. But so if that's triggering for you, maybe skip a couple of minutes. But basically, Jack Lasseter is displaying every domestic violence red flag in existence.
Oh, completely.
And like I said last time, women who get into abusive relationships, more often than not, when people are like, oh, why did you go out with him then? And, you know, the unhelpful things people say, and they go, well, he didn't hit me on the first date.
No, he but hit Jack my Lasseter, child on the first yeah, date, so...
Yeah.
There's a exactly. Clue.
Like, you know, they don't show their colours right away, but Jack Lasseter really is showing his true colours right away. So there's that, it's not just a red flag, it's, you know, it's, I don't even know, it's a bomb. But then he tells her that because he's the man, he's going to make all the major decisions in their lives without consulting her. She doesn't get a say, and if she doesn't like it, she can leave.
Yeah.
Basically, the man does the decision-making, the woman follows, and... She's like not happy about it, but she's like, well, he's really rich.
Yeah.
And then another red flag is the making it up to her with a lavish grand gesture that's, you know, financially impressive, but really empty, the 6 months in Paris.
But bear in mind, he also tried to make up to her with cheap nylon underwear from Clive Stall. So it's not all roses and hearts, is it? Chocolate
no.
and flowers. Yeah, it's a quite dark. I mean, there's a couple of really dark stories at the moment, and that is very much one of them. I absolutely agree that he's sort of letting her buy into it. And once she's bought into it, then, you know, it's like, well, it was your choice to be with me. Also, he says she reminds him of his dead wife, which is.
Yeah, that's gross.
Gross.
Another thing that I noted was that, you know, how she says you said it was like suddenly it's like an epic love story.
Mm.
I believe the first time she actually says I love you is when he says we're going to Paris. Yeah. I think she's just saying I love you to Paris. I don't think she means I love you, Jack. I think she means I love you, Paris.
Yeah.
And Des really disappointed me in this storyline because he shows no concern for Bradley's future. He's quite happy to wash his hands of the kid that he was committing to be a dad for life to a few months ago. And I know that it was Andrea's deception that brought Bradley into his life, but he knew about that when he made that commitment to Bradley, whose fault it wasn't. And Bradley's really down. He's like, can I still call you a dad? And Des is like, yeah, sure. He's like, well, will you still be my dad? And Des is like, no.
It's really terrible. Hard. And when he leaves, he says, bye, Dad. Yeah. That's really heartbreaking. So, like, the funny thing is that obviously I just said about how Zoe is instantly forgives Bradley for all the things that he did. But I have, over the last few weeks of us doing the show, I mean, not last few weeks, in real life, I have forgiven Bradley because he's the product of his environment. You know, he doesn't know how to not be manipulative, and all he wants is a bit of love, you know.
Yeah. And he's a good kid, really, actually, underneath it all. He's got a good heart. He does right by Lucy more than any of the men on Ramsay Street do right by their partners.
100%. Or by Lucy. He treats Lucy better than anyone treats Lucy.
Yep, absolutely. And we'll get to Mrs. York, but he's also very sweet about Mrs. York for a kid that age. What a bleak end for poor Bradley. I would have loved Bradley to have stayed and been like an adoptive son to Des and Daphne. Yeah,
he should have been the Toadfish Rebecca to Carl and Susan.
He should have. And Daphne would have been great for him because she has that experience working with kids from troubled backgrounds.
Yeah.
And that they sort of set that up for her quite early on. They had that random girl that she sort of mentored. We've seen her be a parent figure to Mike. Yeah. Why couldn't she have been a parent figure to Bradley and had Andrea leave? Because Andrea, as much as, you know, I do, obviously, you know, in real life, I think everything should be done to keep families together as long as they're not abusive. But he is moving into an abusive situation
completely.
Now with Andrea. If he wasn't in one before, an emotionally abusive situation with her, which arguably I think he was. But yeah, that was a really sad end for Bradley for me. And I loved Bradley as a character and I loved his growth. And I think the show will be poorer for not having him on it. And it's a shame.
It's also that he does have a biological parent. Another one who sort of no one mentions anymore. And I don't know if we really know how evil the dad was, but it's, you can't just whisk a child out of a country. She's already whisked him away. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, his background is so dysfunctional. And yeah, I'm team Brad now.
Me too.
Bradders, I think. He's really Bradders because I think Brad is really the later Brad. But
yeah,
a lot of repeating of names, which I suppose is inevitable if you have a show that runs for that number of years. But no, think about it. It's quite a few, you know, names get repeated. Anyway,
it's helpful if you're tuning in for the first time.
Yeah, Bradders, OG Bradley.
Yes, rest in, well, he's not dead, but yeah. Goodbye. Godspeed.
Side point, Des gives him like a massive present. Like he gives Andrea a little wedding/engagement present. And then he gives Bradley, when they've just finished packing because they're going abroad, a massive, huge present in a box. And then says to him, you probably have to leave it here for when you come back. And I thought, what an idiot.
Never. Also, Lucy gives him a jigsaw puzzle to do on the journey.
Oh, no.
You can't do a jigsaw puzzle on a journey. You're going to lose pieces. You can't lug that thing around. What's she thinking? That's a very impractical travel gift.
Maybe she doesn't know how you get to France from Australia.
Maybe not.
Which nor do I, really. I suppose you fly. I doubt there's a train. If there was a train, a jigsaw would be useful.
It's a very long plane journey. You have those tiny little tables. It's going to be really cramped in the 80s. Bradley's not doing a jigsaw puzzle on that plane. Anyway, it's a thought that counts, Lucy.
You can take it out of the box and put it into a plastic bag and take a photo of the front cover, take it to the chemist, they'll have it developed, and then it will all fit into his small carry bag.
That's a lovely idea. From one depressing storyline to another, we come to poor Mrs. York. May she rest in peace, because she actually is dead. Spoiler alert. I don't understand why we had to sit through this depressing after school special with absolutely no message because she dies. And then just to make it an extra bummer, they throw in a dead dog. So the entire first week of episodes is taken up by the Ramsay Street Revenants. I'll start that again. The entire first week of episodes is taken up by the Why can't I say this? The entire first week of episode is taken up by all the characters benevolently harassing an elderly lady who's fallen on hard times and doesn't want their help. And repeatedly says, leave me alone, I don't want your help. But they're like, no, you don't understand. You're on a soap opera.
We have to help Lucy you.
Lucy and Bradley. Lucy and Bradley leave her food. Daphne gets involved. Madge gets involved. They busybody their way in. Clive somehow gets involved. He's just there at exactly the right time when she happens to have been collapsed on the couch. And he gets there just in time to save her with his sexy doctor voice and tell Mrs. Mangle to shut up, who is also there for some reason. I don't remember. They rescue her. They get sort of a social framework in place. They get her to admit she needs help. They get financial advice from Des, whose solution to everything seems to be you should have a unit. Well, does Des have shares in local units?
Presumably. To me, like what I wrote, because I just kept writing one word next to people's names. I wrote Mrs. York Nebuch. Now, for those who aren't long-term Yiddish speakers listening to this, someone who's a nebuch is someone who's like, you know, oh, how am I going to describe it? They sort of, you feel sorry for them. Like they've sort of, at the end of their rope, they're a poor little person. And so it's like a sympathy, but also patheticness. I can't explain any better than that. You know, because initially it's that pride has led her to this situation of being reluctant to accept help when she's fallen on difficult times. Her husband passed away and she couldn't afford the upkeep of their property. So she's just been selling all her belongings off and she can't afford food. And she wants to mainly to feed her dog. So she's trying to get sort of scraps and things for the dog. And then she shares them with him in a very poignant moment that I felt didn't bear repeating and yet was repeated. it's another of these weird stories where someone goes from 0 to 60 in terms of their relationship with every other resident in the street, because all that anyone knew about her from before was that she was a rich lady who'd been quite generous with donations. That's the backstory. And then by the end of this story, or not quite the end, prior to her, you know, departing, that you've got Nikki saying, well, my mum bumped into her once when she was here, so she'll really care what happens to her. Suddenly everyone is not just, you know, kids who offered to mow her lawn, but they're visiting this poor woman in hospital relentlessly. And and also thought it was really interesting because she addresses her peers as Mrs., you know, Mrs. Daniels, Mrs. Mitchell, but Clive is Clive. Because that's the vibe when it comes to Clive.
Clive is like Beyonce. He only has the first name.
But it's just, yeah, this constant kind of... And also she begs... I put here, Madge is the most aggressive new friend ever. She will not leave her alone. But she begs Madge to keep her secret. And the secret lasts. And this is, again, a Ramsey Street tradition to this very day. The secret doesn't last 30 seconds. Her secret. I'm just looking if I've written anything else about this. Oh, I put, if Mrs. York had this many visitors before she became ill, she wouldn't be in this state! Exclamation mark.
We're your friends, they keep saying. Are you?
We paid no attention.
I just want to add that I do know that Beyonce and Clive both have last names. But anyway, apparently for Mrs. York, a unit is a fate worse than death because she immediately carks it.
No, she waits till they've gone out to buy her groceries. That's all I can think of, is they came back with that. First of all, Daphne and Madge go and visit her with groceries. And then that's when it turns out she's collapsed. So those groceries go to waste, presumably. And then once she comes back home after her indeterminate amount of time in hospital being harassed by her neighbours, and they bring her home, they go out to get groceries for her, and then they come back and she's dead. That's a second lot of groceries.
Oh my god,
who's got so much?
What a waste.
There. Yeah, and then the dog dies, which is just, you know, let's keep the dog happy. The dog pines like I'm trying to remember Greyfriars Bobby in Edinburgh. The dog pines away for its owner, and it's that sort of sweet, but also, I mean, we didn't need to see it enacted in that dramatic fashion of finding
not to traumatize anyone,
the dead dog on the doorstep like something from the mafia.
Yeah. Fry's dog in Futurama comes to mind. Sorry, everyone. Sorry to bring that up. Let's never think about that again. I really enjoyed how Helen tried to cheer her up about the dead dog. Yeah. And did such a ham-fisted way. She's like, no, don't worry, Lucy. At least he was miserable before he died. Uh-huh. Thanks, Helen.
Mrs. York's funeral, they all went to. You know, again, they could have potentially visited her before she needed the funeral. But there was a comment about whistling. I'm trying to remember who was whistling, and people got very angry about it.
Scott, I think, wasn't it?
Were, don't whistle, don't whistle. And I was like, but they did that as though we should all know. I had to Google what that was. Apparently,
was it Scott?
Whistling, I'm trying to remember, but someone was whistling and everyone freaked out about it. But
Scott was happy.
Whistling, apparently, is said to bring bad luck or summon spirits. So it's very disrespectful in an environment of a funeral.
Oh, I did not know that. Well, it does seem like just generally a disrespectful, just a disrespectfully glib thing to do at a funeral.
Well, he was the most realistic person. And I'm really, obviously, none of us are fans of Scott at this juncture. But no. I did feel like he was kind of realistic in that he wasn't that bothered about an old lady who didn't really know dying.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, we are all Scott in this moment. I didn't also enjoy how Helen tried to make Lucy feel better about death, but made it sound so awesome that Lucy's like, I can't wait to die.
Well, you know, that's grandparenting for you. I'll be sure to make sure I speak to my grandson about it in the same way.
Oh. Yeah, cheers, Helen. This storyline pissed me right off. Tom and Jean.
Tom and Jean. Well, the first thing I made a note of is it does seem that the Ramsay men have a type, and that type is teachers. Max and Tom both have a thing about a teacher. And yeah, that's my in-depth analysis of the situation. Yeah, Tom's date. I'm going to guess that the thing that annoyed you the most about this was this comment. Let me find it. This is Tom to Madge about manipulating Jean into a date by getting Shane to arrange to meet her and then not turn up. And he says this with emotion and feeling. I like her very much. And when a bloke feels that strongly, he sometimes has to use a bit of deception.
Yeah, that pissed me off. But that wasn't the thing that pissed me off the most.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. The thing, I'll get to the thing that pissed me off the most, but so Tom goes on a date with Jean, the business teacher. Yeah. The useless fucker gets oil all over his shirt, and then he doesn't know how to iron another one, and he asks Danny for help, but Danny's equally useless and doesn't know that an oven is hot or what to do if an oven is hot, and they're both like flapping about the kitchen like, what is this silver shiny thing that I can see my face in? Like, they don't know anything. The date actually goes pretty well, despite
it goes
it
well
being
apart
Tom.
From him saying I'll have meat and we should get something lighter for you.
Yeah, what the fuck? I forgot about that.
It's like
a guy ordering for you is a red flag, a guy being like, moment on the lips.
I think not asking you what you want is like, anyway, continue.
Gross. So after multiple attempts of Tom trying to violate her clearly stated boundaries after she blows him off, she explains herself when he basically barges in and demands that Clive tell him what's going on. And Clive's like, well, she's here, just tell him. And look, I'm not physically disabled. I am chronically ill. I do have a neurological disability and I'm quite involved in disability advocacy.
Yeah.
And I know it's 1985 and I know that like attitudes haven't moved on much since then. But can we not, with the tragic disabled trope and the put upon wife who is like, oh no, you don't understand, I have a husband but he's a quadriplegic so he's basically not a person anymore, fuck off with that. He's not dead, he's still her husband. Disabled people can have happy marriages, disabled people can have fulfilling lives, disabled people in care can still have lots of value to themselves, their loved ones, and have a quality of life. This messaging that like, yeah, I'm married, but he's not a real person is what I got from it. And it I know it's 1985, 1986, whatever. It's so grim, and this is still how people think about disabled people. And
there's definitely that thing where people and certainly disabled characters and things have been like, I want you to find love and whatever I can't give you and whatever. And I thought that was really the route they were going down with this, because then Tom's saying, well, can I come and meet him? Like, maybe I can become friends with him or whatever. And I don't know. That was a bit ugly, really.
Yeah.
But
yeah, he was injured in Vietnam, which is, you know, at least era specific and like an interesting thing, I guess, is the only interesting thing about the storyline.
We're not going to develop a relationship with him and his backstory, because he's a character that doesn't appear.
He's an object.
He's an object, exactly. He's a prop. He's a prop to enhance Gene's storyline. But as regular listeners to the pod will know, I too am a neurodivergent person with other neurological issues. And I went through a period of losing my mobility in my speech about 25, 26 years ago for quite some time. And I think, that I'm not saying that I have the experience of being a quadriplegic. Obviously, things are different. And also, if you have a condition which, however traumatic, is temporary, it's not the same as a condition that's permanent. But just the idea that my husband would find dealing with me so tragic that he'd go off and have a fling with one of his students. Well, at the time, actually, he taught in a primary school, so there's many levels at which that would have been problematic. I don't know. I agree with you. I think, like, you know, people are allowed to stay in love with someone who's experiencing physical problems, and to find their own route to make their lives work. And I suppose for some people, they do come to whatever arrangements, but this hasn't been handled with that vibe of, get your oats somewhere else if we can't do it in a way that's going to satisfy you. That's not been the storyline. It's been more because he's just someone she visits in hospital.
Yeah,
she's got an outside interest now. But I kind of like the fact that she feels bad about it, because she loves him and she's only ever loved her husband, and so she wants to put a stop to anything that could go anywhere else. I think that's sort of that's a bit redeeming, maybe.
Yeah, it's more the show's attitude than her attitude.
I have an aversion, and this is true of all soaps and in fact all media really, where a person's disability is used as a tool for other people's behavior, as a that character's personal development, if you see.
Absolutely.
So and I don't think we have enough people in any soap where they have a disability, and it's just like, just apart from who they are. Like, I think, and this isn't a disability thing, but I think Neighbours has been quite good with certain things. So we've talked before about Mackenzie, right? So obviously it's not a disability, but Mackenzie's transness is an element of her character. It's part of what's made her the person she is. But also, she's a person who works in a law office. She's somebody who messes up relationships. She's somebody, she's a 360 degree person. And that is an aspect of her. And I'd love to see in more TV, particularly, someone where their deafness isn't their whole storyline. You know, that's their tragic story, because, you know, deaf people have lives and have friends and communicate, and it's just a different language, and don't be lazy about it. Do you know what I mean? As writers. That sort of thing.
I'd like to see more Curtis, because I think that Curtis as well, like in the present day, not to step on any toes, but just quickly zooming forward to the present day, Curtis is a character who I think ticks all those boxes, that his deafness isn't treated like a tragedy. And I would really like to see more of him, and also the double act that is him and Vera Punt. Please, and please, 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 an autistic character, an openly autistic character, an openly neurodivergent character on Neighbours. We had ADHD with Scott. I'm not sure if it would have been handled with Stingray. I'm not sure it would have been handled the same way today as it was then. I think we know a lot more now, and we have different attitudes towards neurodivergence now. But autistic character on Neighbours, please, if anyone is listening, please, 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 and please do not make their whole storyline how they impact other people and how they keep melting down and how unreasonable they are. Give an autistic person a proper arc and character. Anyway, whatever, I digress. Back to 1986.
Yeah.
Because I do not care about Jean and Tom at all. I also do not care about these people. I mean, I care about Paul because he's Paul, kind of. But Paul, Shane, and young, sexy Deborah, I'm just going to shorten to YSD.
Again. YSD.
Yeah.
It says here in my notes, Deborah is vile.
Oh, yeah.
And then above that, by the way, it says Mrs. Mangle is gross. And below it, it says Jack Laster is awful. So that's, I told you, that's, those are my notes. But Deborah, Deborah was one of the storylines that I felt like, you've made your point. Now, can we just move on? And they've made her such a panto villain.
Yep.
It's just boring, 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 dull, dull, dull.
Yeah, I've literally covered it in like two sentences.
Yeah,
which is just that Jim points out that YSD is a spy. Duh. Mm. Paul does the full spy that shagged me, like by shagging her.
Yeah.
But he knows about her being a spy because Jim told him. And before then, he was like, "What, really?"
Well, he was planting an idea, and this isn't a euphemism. He wanted to give her a fake name of a fake company to see if she tries to go after their fake contract. And he also tests out Zoe, who's returned to work, by leaving a contract, looking about on her desk to see if she does anything with it. And she honestly returns it because Zoe is not famed for her honesty, but is honest in this one situation.
She's been ramsified.
She's been ramsified. So now she's honest as the day is long. So I feel like Paul really could have chosen to not have intimacy, as we call it when we talk about these things, with Deborah. But then where's the fun in that? That's
it. They didn't have to take it to the next level.
I was just trying to think of what are the euphemisms on television, and like intimacy is one they use a lot on Australian programs.
I also found it very boring, this whole thing with Shane. Shane slights her so she conspires to get him fired. The only funny bit of it was when she phones Helen and she doesn't even put on a fake voice. No. She just calls with her own voice to do like a prank job. And
can we have a driver for very far away, please? Do you know that that's very far away? Yes, I really want it to be far, far away. And also, by the way, I put Deborah and Paul have the least sexy kiss I've ever seen on television.
Really? I must have pouncy. Zoned out. Ugh. Grim. Whatever. Shane gets fired. Then he gets rehired. I don't care. By Paul or something. I forgot he worked at Lasseter's. I don't care.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's doing the landscaping because Clive's dropped out to sell underwear. Well, to sell specifically, here's the list of what he sells: tap shoes, knickers, and hearing aids, available in matching colors. So he's quite busy. So yeah, Shane's dealing with the landscaping, which he has minimal experience, and but he has to keep getting replacements so he can go and drive people for Helen.
Wait, the hearing aids, the tap shoes, and the underwear are all in matching colors. So like, what, for
matching colors?
For the sexy deaf tap dancers out there, this is your one-stop shop.
Well, this is the story we're asking them to make, isn't it? Why shouldn't there be a sexy deaf tap dancer? Quite right. Yeah.
Give us a sexy deaf tap dancer, you cowards.
Yeah. Do it now.
Yeah. Des and Daphne are engaged again. They're in love again. They're planning their second attempt at a wedding. Des gets Daphne a huge rock, not a euphemism. There are funny things that come out of this. Just a couple, like Lucy asking if she can recycle her dress because Lucy is thrifty, and I stan. Des, this is such a weird fucking scene. Des asking Shane to be his best man.
Yes, I wrote that as well. Yes, that, it's so weird. Why would you do that? Also, why has Helen got fashion magazines? And also, why is she? Because it's not a thing she's ever expressed an interest in at any other point in the character. And also, while they're having that conversation, her and Lucy, she's trying to cheer Lucy up, and Lucy's saying, can I have the same bridesmaid's dress? And she's saying, well, I think Zoe will choose different colours, maybe you will as well, as opposed to saying, no, because that wedding was a disaster, so let's have something fresh. One of her buttons has come undone on her cardigan, and that's all I could think about in that whole scene.
That is very distracting. I just want to come back to this Des Daphne Shane scene for a second, because it was so bizarre. Des asks Shane to be his best man. Shane sort of hesitates for half a second and he's like, "Of course. I thought you'd never ask. Did you? I mean, yeah, you probably did think you'd never ask.
Yeah, why would you ask?"
Yeah. And then Daphne comes over to give him a hug and it turns a little bit steamy and Des is like, "Okay, stop it now." And they all laugh awkwardly, like big joke. They're gonna bone right here in the coffee shop. It was so weird. I'm trying, apologies for abandoning my Instagram activities. I basically was subtitling things and now like the thing I was using doesn't work anymore and I'm just really rubbish. If anyone knows a good subtitling app that isn't TikTok, for some reason the clips aren't working on TikTok and whatever, anyone help me, how do I subtitle these videos without a lot of faff? Like someone tell me the answer, because Googling is not, it's just sending me to a bunch of other apps that you have to pay a subscription and they don't work. Anyway, that's a little
is
admin.
Is that a subtext to "you had a good clip you wanted to share of that scene"?
Yeah.
Okay, just for anyone confused.
I wanted to share a clip of that scene and I've got it ready to go and I don't want to put it up without subtitles, so if anyone can help point me in the right direction. I am useless, I don't know what I'm doing, help me. Anyway, I don't that's all really about that wedding, unless you had anything else to say. Oh, I was going to say that if I was there at the time, I would 100% troll them by showing up in a gorilla costume as a guest.
Yes, I would as well. Or send them like gorilla themed, you know, presents and cards. I would go 100% gorilla for this.
Fantastic. Drop Dead Fred. Thus named because Charlene's horrible dad is named Fred and Drop Dead is what I was yelling at the screen when he was on it. So
yeah,
that's what I would like him to do.
Yes, where's my notes about Fred and his general grimness? He's such a, and actually I have to say he's just like not even an enjoyable character to watch, because you don't hate him enough to like fully invest in the hatreds, because he's just weedy. But he's not got a nice enough side that you think, yeah, but there's this bit of him that really cares about, I don't know, the plight of the fruit bat or whatever it might be. And he is very, very pervy.
Yeah.
So like he arrives and sees her snogging Shane. Not only does that not bother him, but at a later point he says, you know, when she kisses Shane goodbye, he's like, "Go on, like kiss him properly. None of us mind watching you kiss him properly."
Do you mean Scott?
Oh, Scott. Yeah, not Shane. Yeah, Scott. Ugh. I mean, that, yeah, that's her cousin. And ugh. But also, yeah. Why would...
There's a twist.
I mean, I don't understand why she's pleased to see him after the way they parted company. And why would Lenny think Madge would be pleased to see him? Like, it's really not a well-handled story when it comes to continuity. Although not as bad continuity as today's episode of Contemporary Neighbours, where, for example, you see Mel leaving the therapist in a coat and arriving home without the coat. But let's not go there. My brain is very tiring.
Maybe she lost the coat on the way home.
Maybe, but then you need to say that. But yeah, but this with Charlene, I totally get kids want to love their parents and they want their parents to be better people than they are. But Madge is being like a proper strong woman and standing her ground. And even Charlene stands her ground to Scott about what she will and won't do with him at this point. But she, yeah, about her dad, it's always, if someone's really sorry, give them a second chance. He deserves to be listened to despite having a baby with another person and only come here because that person's, you know, walked out. Fred is a tale as old as time. Mm-hmm. But they had, yeah. They've sort of tried to make his desire to be back with Madge a bit romantic by putting in music that's sort of crashing strings over him talking and trying to say, yeah, but tell me, do you love me or not? It's horrible, horrible.
It's like The Sims, isn't it? Yeah, it's really bad. He's back. Charlene is behaving like she's 10 years younger than she is and doesn't understand how adult relationships work at all. Like, she's behaving like a needy six-year-old.
Yeah.
She really is, and it's very grating to watch. Obviously, we love Kylie, we love Charlene, but like, I'm not here for this bratty screaming at her mum to just get back with her horrible dad who's let her down so many times. He, even when he's trying to win her over, he's terrible. He says to her basically like, oh, I should have known Susan was too young and hot to want me. Madge, how about it?
Yeah, let's get back together, Madge. Gross.
Like, if a man said that to me, he would be leaving short a few key body parts.
I don't think he'd get that far with you. I think you'd have, I don't think, certainly not with this back history. And it's also like, he goes to get a job from, like, Paul needs a new barman because the replacement barman may or may not be a good enough barman. There's a whole conversation about that with Jack Laster that was so uninteresting. I wanted to peel my eyeballs off. But Paul says, oh, I can give you a job here as a barman. And then says, I was going to advertise, but I'd rather have someone I can trust. Fred. Fred is the someone he can trust. Why? What's Fred ever done that's trustworthy? And how well does Paul know him to know that now he can trust him? What is that about?
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense.
No.
It doesn't make any sense at all. I kind of just tuned out at that point because it was so dull. But the upshot is that Madge, it's even the financial swindling is boring. Like, he's in debt, he needs Madge's ring, which is worth 10 grand. Then he takes out a loan worth 5 grand. Then Madge gives him the 10 grand for the ring, but takes his 5 grand and it's going to be a loan. And then he leaves and says he's coming back, but it's clearly not coming back. The end, I guess.
Well, there's also, he does try initially to take her on a night out that no one discusses who's going to pay for. But everything, and then he buys her presents. This is another, like, it's like Jack Lasseter, you know, where he gets presents out of the money she gives him that's supposed to bail him out from the heavies. I'd quite like the heavies to have a bit of a go. But also, Fred says this, I mean, this is just such an inane statement to Madge. Oh, Madge, you look lovely when you smile. How comes you don't do that so much anymore? How comes? Because of you. That's why she doesn't do it anymore. And you know it's because of you. That's why she didn't want to take you back. Everything about it was awful.
Yep. In the bin with Fred.
In the bin. I mean, the bin is going to be full at the end of this.
It really is. I mean, we've lost a lot of characters this month. We'll get to the next one in a second. But this month, like it's fortnight, we've lost Mrs. York.
Yeah, her dog.
Mrs. York's dog. Yeah. Bradley. Andrea, Jack Lasseter, Nikki. So that's six. These people are dropping like flies.
I know, and not all the people you'd want to leave. Like, I quite like Nikki now. In some, not completely, not like in a how I like Bradders, but at least Nikki's got a bit more depth to her.
Yeah.
Let's get rid of Jim and Paul and Shane and Scott.
Yeah, I've got bad news for you on the Paul front.
Seriously.
Spoiler alert, not going to happen.
I don't know what to say.
Briefly until 2005, I think. But yes. The teen gang. So this whole thing causes a rift between Charlene and Madge, which is ongoing. But I'll get to that in a second. Nikki and Mike break up because he's going on a diving trip and she won't do his homework. Young love.
It's I feel like this was enjoyably adolescent because she's being kind of unreasonable, not about them not doing the homework, because that's fair, but like about not wanting him to go away and not wanting him to, you know, because he should go away if diving is something he's interested in as a healthy pastime or a career. You know, she should be supporting him in that, even though she's going to miss him a lot. And his training is taking up a lot of his time. And he has to work because his family don't support him, etc. So, like, he doesn't have a lot of available time. So she could just say, well, I'm so flattered that in your 30 seconds a week you have, you want to spend it snogging me on a bench or whatever. You know, but I also think that if you're 15 or 16 or however old they're meant to be, or 98, it's very hard to tell, then you would feel, and especially because, you know, she has a difficult past herself, she might feel a bit bereft and a bit hard done by and a bit neglected. And, you know, I think her reaction is appropriate for her her purported age.
Indeed. I think, yeah, it was realistic, and I did appreciate that. And then we lose Nikki quite abruptly because she finds out that her mum has MS, and it's very sad the way that she leaves the street. She's crying and she's not happy to leave, and she's leaving very worried about her mum.
Yeah.
And
everyone's
again,
not
we have,
telling her.
Yeah. Again, we have a disability that is just a plot device for an abled character.
Yes, completely.
Just to point
and
out.
And also they treat it like her diagnosis is an immediate death sentence.
Yeah.
You know, like, no, when Ashley got her diagnosis, I better move back because she certainly isn't going to last out my final year of school that I'm three quarters of the way through.
Yeah. There is a very unintentionally funny scene with Helen when she finds out, at this point, all she knows is that Laura's feeling a bit under the weather.
Yeah.
Like she's a bit out of sorts. Like she has no more information than this. And Helen's sitting on the sofa, clutching a framed photograph of Laura to her chest.
Because of the devastation.
Imagine, right, like you find out, I don't really understand what Laura's relationship to Helen is. She calls Nikki her niece, but Laura can't be her sister.
I think Laura is her niece and Nikki is her great niece, but right. You don't always call, like, I didn't call my great aunts, great aunt, whatever, I just called them auntie.
Yeah, sure.
That's, I okay. think that, I could be wrong, and if I am wrong, one of you would tell us.
Yes, if anyone knows what the relationship actually is, I can't be bothered to look it up, please someone do that for me. But imagine you find out that your niece is feeling a little bit under the weather and is going to the GP. Is your reaction like, oh, I hope they're okay, mild concern, or sitting on the sofa clutching a framed photograph of that person to your chest?
I mean, I'm really terrible at remembering to take photos. I'm worse at printing them out, and I literally have about two photos in frames in existence, and I can see them both from here. Neither of them are any of my nieces, and I've got a few nieces, so I'd be hard pushed to do that with the best of intentions.
I feel like Helen had that photo printed and framed especially, like, the second she heard, like, she's got the sniffles,
she's got shit.
Like, off she goes to Snappy Snaps.
Yeah, completely. And then she decides obviously to go and visit her, and the excuse she gives is, I'm flying to Brisbane tomorrow for a business deal.
The boys go diving on their diving trip, but they get confused and accidentally go surfing, I guess.
Well, I think they're doing diving in the afternoon and they've got the morning to surf / come on to local freelance models.
Yes. They meet a hot stranger who Scott is all over right away. Mm. Just saying. When did he and Lenny get back together? Because I don't remember seeing them. I remember seeing them become friends again, but suddenly now they're holding hands and kissing again, and she's his girlfriend. So I don't know when that happened. Oh, did I miss something?
I don't remember. We'll have to go back and look because it's been a while. But I did write before they left, Scott is pathetic. He said something about the holiday. Not the holiday, that their trip, which is supposed to be like a school training-y trip. He said something like, I'm just so excited. Oh, I'm going to relax and have some fun. You're supposed to be going to train and become a better diver.
Yep. So Mike saves the hot diver, surfer. See, I'm getting confused now. Mm. It's just water sports, whatever. Indeed. Mike saves the hot stranger from drowning because she has a leg cramp. Nikki who?
Oh, very quickly over her. Yeah. But in fairness, they've been getting each other's nerves for some time. And they aren't together, but it's still, it is fast, but it's not illegal.
She's not even cold yet.
But also, this person he saves, Cassie, she's a lot.
That's the one. Mm.
She's a lot. And they meet for drinks in the morning. Well, we've got the Kylie bit, the Charlene turning up at their love nest. But I've said too many things. I think we need to just take out everything I just said. Cassie comes back to their motel room, and then they have to come to an arrangement about, if you hang a sock on the door, don't come and knock in when the motel room is a rocking conversation that he has with Scott. And I got the impression that the vibe was, how can I euphemize this? Now I have become a man.
Yes.
That was...
They took it to the next level.
Yes. The waves crashed on the shore. And and he's a bit over... I'm sure he feels like now he must be in love with her. So this is all very exciting. And they're going to go out the next day and everyone's very excited. But then they get a surprise visitor.
Charlene has run away from home.
Yes, and come straight to where Scott's having a holiday and relaxing instead of training. And his phone call with Jim is so whiny. Because Jim calls him with Madge to say, like, listen, Charlene says she's going to turn up around yours and it's not good. Try and encourage her to come back. And he's like, well, I'll just handle it as best as I can. It's very Kevin and Perry.
He has like an oily parent voice that he uses when he's trying to get out of trouble. Mm. Like, Dad, I've never even seen a girl before. Like, he used it when he was accused of sexual assault. He used it when he was sexually assaulting Charlene last week. Mm. And he's using it now. So forgive me if, like, I'm skeptical every time that oily little voice comes on. He's like, I've never done anything wrong in my life. And it's like, this psychopath is a seasoned liar. And like in this instance, it happened to be true, but honestly, I wouldn't have been surprised. Yeah, exactly. If the camera had panned out and Charlene had been sitting right next to him, that would not have shocked me.
Or anyone, or at least of all Charlene. So the next morning, they all go off to meet Cassie for drinks / soft drinks, where the lovely expression is low cal for the girls, high cal for the boys. Which is really no different from Tom's earlier shenanigans.
And then only dainty lady food for the little women.
Completely. And then Cassie manages to convince Mike to sack off his training, the only reason for which he's there, and will almost definitely get him into big trouble, to come back to hers. But also she takes off her earring to drive, side point. Why would you? I don't know why that's necessary. She takes off her earring and then she very ostentatiously puts her earring back on when she stops driving. Takes her back.
What?
Takes she just does.
I didn't notice that, seriously.
I don't know. I mean, I don't have pierced ears, but I manage to drive fine. Anyway, she's just got a bit of business to attend to before they can get down to a bit of business of their own. And the bit of business turns out to be nude modelling.
Indeed. Dun, dun, dun. Mike's tongue is on the floor.
Yeah.
I don't want to think about what else is going on.
Like in a sort of ogre type noise.
Yeah. His eyes pop out of his head and that is the end of these episodes.
Mm. Can I just add that when Scott discovers that Cassie and Mike are turning him into a man in the motel room, he sits on the floor outside. Like, he doesn't go off and get a coffee somewhere and come back in. He could come back in fairness, probably a couple of minutes. But that's very weird.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's in character for Scott, isn't it?
Yeah. I don't know.
Little pervert, gross, little ratty, gross. Anyway, whatever. I'm not a fan of Scott. I have a couple of stray observations before you get to what I assume will be copious stray observations. The first stray observation is Jim giving Zoe the shittest supermarket flowers ever bought by any man, and Daphne saying she'll love them as her nose grows 10 feet.
Jim will not leave Zoe alone. She is very carefully and clearly explained why she needs to be left alone by him, and he will not leave her alone or respect her wishes. And again, like, I was sort of quite proud of her and Madge for kind of standing their guns. And then later she has a whole conversation with Daphne about how much she misses Jim and how hard it is, and I thought that was unnecessary. But
but that makes it even more admirable that she's sticking to her guns, because she that's a really hard thing to do when you have strong feelings for somebody and they're bad for you.
Yeah.
I think most people would take a lot longer to excise someone from their life who they are very attracted to and or have strong feelings for, but who they know objectively is just toxic. So, yeah. Second stray observation, the way that Madge pronounces Tarzan, which I'm going to drop a little clip in here.
That is funny.
That I really enjoyed that. And final stray observation, Cocoa Pops watch. Fruit Loops have been added to the rotation of Ramsay Street cereals for a start, just to point that out. And crisis hits the Robinson household when the Cocoa Pops box is empty, leaving Jim with no Cocoa Pops.
But they do have Kellogg's just right.
They do. There's even a line where Scott goes, "Oh, bad luck, Dad." That is basically, in my mind, canonically Cocoa Pops being a speaking extra at this point.
Aww. That's
over to you, Rachel, for your eagle-eyed observations.
That, just before my eagle-eyed observations, I just want to add in that the conversation about Zoe and her phone call with her mum was really, really, really sad. And her self-awareness, and I thought, oh, there's a bit of development as a character, and that was nice. Okay,
yeah, so that means she's on her way out
almost definitely. Right, here are my Rachel's observations. I really need like a jingle.
Rachel's observations.
So in the first of these episodes, episode 281, Madge is cutting carrots in the least practical way I've ever seen anyone chop a carrot in my life. I mean, I do a lot of cooking, and if I cut my carrots like Madge cuts her carrots, I would have given up probably a year of my life in carrot cutting alone, because she peels them, cuts them into like rounds, you know, like slices them, and then she cuts each of those one by one into quarters. No one's ever chopped a carrot like that. That shouldn't happen. It shouldn't be allowed. Second of all, Helen has not just fashion magazines, she has pamphlets of advice for the elderly. What else does she have in her room? She has everything.
She's running a news agent in there.
Third of all, when Mrs. York forgives the kids and wants and sort of lets them come to the house and sort of they have a nice chat, the treat she offers them is to help put Billy's new flea collar on. And I just thought, wow, what a reward. Come and put a new flea collar on my dog. Next one. I love that Kylie goes to the business classes. I don't know, I keep writing Kylie, but I mean obviously Charlene. I love that Lenny goes to the business classes. I think that's cool. We love Lenny. Mrs. Mangler's gross, it says underneath. This group of episodes has a lot of what Joey and Friends describes as smell the fart acting. If they edited out all the time people looked in far into the faraway distance, the episode would be 3 seconds long. It happens constantly and it's unnecessary. If there's no action, you don't have to be filming them. My next point is, this is like an exam now. I'm on a roll. That Shane is watching cartoons when Helen finishes getting dressed because he's going to presumably take her to the airport for her, imagine my fingers doing quote marks, Brisbane business trip. And Shane is enjoying those cartoons like someone who's been in a desert and comes across an oasis.
I really enjoyed that.
Anyone enjoying cartoons. And he like points at the TV to make sure that Helen can see that, the cartoons are really, really funny. And that was weird.
Watch the cartoon acting.
Exactly. Oh my God, Tom's wig. Whatever. That's it. But I'm going to end. You mentioned the cereal, which was also on my list. And then I've already moaned about Helen's cardigan button and Cassie's earring, which makes me hate myself a little bit. Yes, I'm going to end with a sad one, which is Lucy Robinson's poignant statement. When I say goodbye, people don't come back. And it made me wonder whether Lucy might be, like patient zero in this situation. But maybe she needs to stop saying goodbye to people. You know, that is the factor that relates to all the people who are disappearing from her life.
She's cursed. Oh, another couple of things that I forgot. First of all, Cassie taking and Lenny taking against each other immediately as two hot young women right. who are viable sexual rivals, even though they're not interested in the same boy. It is as nature intended, I guess, in 1986, whatever. And the second thing that I found really, really weird was Nikki's goodbye with Clive.
Yeah.
What was that?
I mean, it's hard to know. Everyone loves Clive.
But they were basically making it. It was like she's a teenager that he doesn't really know that. I guess
I mean,
he knows
that means nothing. He knows that. I mean, Mrs. York is his best friend.
Very, very odd moment where she like in, rather than her family, it's Clive she says a tearful goodbye to at the car. So, was that scene meant to be with Mike?
I don't mean to point out the obvious, but if you had to say goodbye to Clive and you've never met him before, but if he just appeared now and you had to say goodbye to him, don't tell me it wouldn't be more full on than that.
Oh, we would need a room. Yeah. But I'm not a 16-year-old girl.
Well, not anymore. No. If you had been, it still would have. Also, by the way, Cassie seems to have very chapped lips, so she might be spending too much time outdoors surfing and stuff if she wants to continue with her modelling career. So she should invest in some Vaseline. Just a side point. Speaking as a mum, you know. And can we sort of do a little toast to the amazing disappearing Danny, who just pops up twice for other people's comedy purposes, but no storyline of his own. He's just being kept on because he has a contract.
He basically shows up every few weeks and goes, "Oh, there go, Uncle Tom," yeah. or something like that, yeah. or like, "Oh, struth, Auntie Madge," and then he walks off again.
If only I knew more Australian sayings.
Yeah, and just before we go, thank you to our incredible community of people who have very patiently stayed with us over this break and who have missed us, and also to everyone who left lovely reviews of my book, Eight Bright Lights.
Your excellent
book.
You're
very lovely. I saw quite a few community members mention that they've either found the book via the podcast or that they were one of the people who got a book in my giveaway and left really, really nice reviews, which really heartened me and cheered me up during a difficult time. And we love you and we're really happy to be back with you. And I'm very excited to learn how to do subtitles so I can get back on the socials and show you all of the fuckery that we've been missing. And I need to go back and watch Cassie taking her earring out. Is it waiting the car too far to the
only
left?
One side she gets out of the car, she parts the car, and then I don't know, there's a lot of business of her, you know. Business is a word that you use in if someone's acting involves a lot of faffing around with a prop for no apparent reason. So there was a lot of business of her clipping on this massive earring, which then she has to take off anyway 10 seconds later. She's got to get naked for the creepy photographer guy. Do you know what it reminded me of, that scene? But I don't know if you would know what this is because you're a bit younger than me, but in the original movie of Fame, as in the kids from Fame, Coco Hernandez gets an agent, but he's not really an agent. He's just a guy who wants to take pervy photos of her, and it's a very distressing scene, very well put together. But that was the flashback that I had watching this with Cassie, except for Cassie seems to have bought into the whole, you know, this is the kind of modelling she does. And
good on her.
Good on her.
She's having a great time.
Why not? She's earning a living. She can rent a flat near the beach in Manly.
She can afford two earrings.
Yeah. And a car.
Yeah.
So, yeah, fair enough.
Living her best life.
But I like that she still is age commensurate in her relationships, because she and Mike are the same age. She just dropped out of school.
There we go. She's made a man out of Mike. And that's all. That's a wrap for this fortnight. We'll be back very soon with more exciting content, more riveting storylines, like old lady we don't know dies. And we'll see you next time.
Yeah, I don't suppose we need to discuss who we're going to chuck out, because
the
show did it for us.
I'm going to get you if you don't leave Aaron's bar now.
I forgot. Who are we going to chuck out? Okay, well, obviously Jack Lasseter.
Out of anyone who's left, I think it should be. People who've gone of their own / the story's volition, no point chucking them out. They're not there.
Okay, who are we going to chuck out? Who are we going to chuck out? I'm going to say... Uncle Tom, not cool violating a woman's boundaries repeatedly and then justifying it by saying that when you like someone, you need to repeatedly violate their boundaries.
I'm going to chuck out Deborah because she is so boring.
Yeah, she is boring.
Sorry,
Deborah. Down with YSD.
Yeah.
And we really will see you next time this time.
Bye.
Bye.
Leaving Erinsborough was hosted by Sarah Gibbs and Rachel Krieger. This episode was edited by John Gibbs. Our logo is by Hayley Charlesworth. Our theme song was mixed by Graham Rawson. Please don't forget to subscribe, rate and review wherever you get podcasts. Join us next time when we'll be covering episodes 291 to 300.